Now, let's talk about civics. Come on, folks. You know what that is, right? Those of us that are older, we kind of, hopefully, studied that in school. Hopefully, they still teach this in school. Although, when you see some actions, I'm thinking, these folks have no idea how our government works, do they? They don't know. So there was an event last month that I just flat missed it. Shame on me. I flat missed it. It was called Civic Learning Week, and it was mainly aimed at schools about, you know, making sure young people know about our form of government, the Constitution, you know, all that stuff. All right. And so I missed it. I'm like, oh, that would have been a great topic. So I reached out anyway to a group called PA Civics, which was involved with this. And thankfully, our guest is part of that. And they said, yeah, we'd like to be on the show. So I'm like, great. So let's welcome to our program former Congressman Jim Gerlach. Congressman, first off, good morning, and thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks much, and good morning to you, and apologize for the confusion yesterday. Hope I didn't know too much.
I thought I was
welcome to our world.
Yeah, I thought I was the only one who gets confused.
Yeah, we're usually the ones confused.
First off, Congressman, may we call you Jim? Is that okay?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, very good. All right. We always like to start with some basic background. So if you would, Jim, first off, I know you've been retired from Congress for, I think, 10 years now, but tell us something about yourself, you know, where you're from. Tell us about your background. I know you were in the state legislature at one point. So first off, tell us about you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Born and raised in a steel town in western Pennsylvania called Elwood City, about an hour north of Pittsburgh. Graduated from high school there and then went to college in central Pennsylvania at Dickinson College, and then stayed after I was a political science major, and then stayed in Carlisle and went to Dickinson Law School. And during my time in Dickinson Law School, I worked over in the state Senate as a legislative assistant for a state senator from Delaware County. And then after graduating from law school, got my first job at a law firm in Chester County outside of Philadelphia. Practiced law for about 10 years and then got elected to the state house in 1990 by defeating a Democrat incumbent of 18 years by 23 votes out of 17,000 votes cast, less than one vote per precinct. And then in turn served two terms in the state house, two terms in the state Senate, and then got elected to Congress in 2002, served six terms, 12 years there. So after 12 years in the legislature, 12 years in Congress, decided to move back into the private sector, headed up a couple business organizations, and then decided to basically semi-retire at the end of last year, which is now where I am, doing some public affairs consulting, but otherwise hopefully being a good granddad to six of grandkids that we have.
Love it. That sounds great. All right. Now, I guess one of the things you do, you're with a group called PA Civics. And I'll be honest, Jim, before last month, I've never heard of this group. What is PA Civics? What do you do?
Yeah. So back in 2018, the former members of Congress Association sent out an email to former members around the country asking us if we would get more involved in promoting civics education in our individual states. And so we teamed up with former Congressman Joe Huffle and a number of other organizations, including the National Constitution Center, Pennsylvania Bar Association, Committee of 70, the Rendell Center, and others, to begin looking at ways that, as a coalition, we can promote civics education in Pennsylvania. So we started with about three organizations as part of the coalition. We're now up to 22. And what we're trying to do is a couple things. One is trying to understand and improve upon Act 35. Around the same time that COVID hit, Governor Wolf signed into law Act 35, which now mandates that schools across Pennsylvania, some point between grade 7 and 12, do a civics assessment to really understand the civic, the level of civic knowledge on the part of our students across Pennsylvania. But it really is a pretty bland and generic kind of mandate, because the individual schools can decide what tests to give their students. And again, it could be given in 7th grade, 8th grade, all the way up to 12th grade. And there's no uniformity across the state as to what that assessment ought to be, and no uniformity as to when a test ought to be given. And when you look at our civics teachers, who we have some great civics teachers in Pennsylvania, but our state civics education standards are pretty vague and ambiguous. They could be teaching civics in 7th grade, 8th grade, all the way up to 12th grade, and no real specific standards that they're using at appropriate grade levels. And so what we've discovered through this collaborative effort is we need to have better civics education standards overall. We need to also help our teachers with their professional development in terms of civics education that they provide in individual schools. And we need to really work with all organizations in the public and private sectors to really underscore the importance of educating our kids so that they're better citizens when they come out of school and can be more engaged and more active as citizens in adult life.
All right. Now, Jim, this might sound like a dumb question, but this is Scott, and I'm really good at dumb questions, so I like to be consistent, okay? Just give a basic definition of civics. What is this? What's supposed to be learned here?
Well, great question. Civics is the education of students in terms of understanding, number one, understanding the formation of our republic, the nature of our government, and the specific rights and responsibilities that individuals have as citizens in our country. And then you weave into that everything from history, you know, what was the history of the Declaration of Independence, of the Constitution, of certain Supreme Court cases that over the course of the last couple hundred years have helped form our nation. You can get part of history into that. You can get part of that civic knowledge. But civics is also taking that knowledge and then going to the second pillar, which is understanding the skills that you need to take that knowledge and be engaged in your community. And then the third pillar of civics is not only having the knowledge and then having the skills, but then also actually undertaking action and activities of an engaged citizen. So a good civics education, if it's done right, is those three pillars of knowledge, of our history, of our background, our structure of government, how it works, to having the skills then to take that knowledge and do something with it, and then the third pillar is actually doing something. So good civics education encompasses all three pillars.
But Jim, maybe right now from what you said a couple minutes ago with schools, very inconsistent. Sounds like it's like all over the lot. Maybe there are some schools that are essentially doing nothing with this. I mean, is any of that accurate?
Well, I think most schools right now are trying on the first pillar to make sure their students have sufficient civic knowledge. You know, what are our three branches of government? How are we structured from a governmental standpoint? How are we founded? What's in the Declaration of Independence and Constitution? I think most civics ed teachers are working hard to try to, at some point, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, trying to get that information across. But very few civics programs across Pennsylvania then get into the skills part of civics and then ultimately the action part of civics. And in fact, what concerns a lot of us is the fact that back in 2021, the Thomas Fordham Institute did an analysis of the quality of civics programs across the 50 states and gave them a grade, surprisingly, A, B, C, or D, or F. Unfortunately, in both our educational standards for civics as well as in history, Pennsylvania got an F grade. And so that's very concerning because according to the Fordham Institute, again, as I mentioned earlier, Our standards are kind of vague. They're not grade specific, grade level specific. They're kind of ambiguous. So the teachers are left in a situation where they have to figure out, okay, if they're teaching civics in the, I don't know, Clarion School District in northwestern Pennsylvania in the eighth grade, what should I teach? What should I make sure my students know versus somebody that might be teaching civics in Kennett Square in Chester County at 10th grade? What should be in my curriculum? So it's all over the board in Pennsylvania, unfortunately. And a lot of that's based on the fact that we've historically been a state where education is defined and carried out at the local school district level. And I think there's very important reasons why that is good. But we need to, in terms of civics education, it seems to me, need to have a state set of standards that focus our teachers on teaching certain things at certain grade levels all across Pennsylvania so that they walk through over the course of these kids' elementary, middle school, and secondary educational careers, that they're getting the knowledge early enough, and then they're getting skills built in over time, and then they're getting action built in over time, so that ultimately when they're graduating at 12th grade level, they really are some well-positioned individuals to be ready to go out there and be really engaged in our society.
All right, Jim, I'll bite. If you have this knowledge, did any state get an A?
Yeah, a few did. I'm trying to, let me beat my memory here. I want to say Florida got an A. Actually, New York ranked very, very high. Massachusetts ranked very, very high. And they've undertaken civic education reforms in the past couple years that I think brought them to those levels. Trying to think out in the central and western part of the country, there's a few states out there. I want to say Utah. It's been a little while since I looked at the report. But, yes, there are a number of states that are at the grade A level, and unfortunately we're down at the bottom of the level. And you throw in, Scott, the fact that, and Jeff, the fact that here we're coming up next year to our 250th celebration, and people are saying, according to a number of surveys, including one that was done by Signal, a group called Signal, back in 2022, most folks want civics education properly taught in the schools because they believe that it's an important thing for our society. Well, overwhelmingly majority, 79% believe teaching civics is important, 69% believe it's more important today than it was just 5 years ago. So I think the public understands the importance of good civics education, and I know our civics teachers do as well, and I think just about all of our educational professionals really believe in the importance of civics, but our state standards are kind of ambiguous and vague, and so how they build that into their local curriculums, that needs to be worked on.
Did the grade catch you by surprise? Because just instinctively, I would think Pennsylvania, just because of the history we have here, like if you're growing up in the Gettysburg area, I can't imagine that you wouldn't have some pretty good civics background.
Or Philadelphia.
In the Philadelphia area, I can't imagine you wouldn't have some. Like, it just, given our history as a state and the, you know, the priority that we at least say we put on education in general, I don't know. That just is surprising that we that we would get an F.
I had that exact same reaction. I throw on top of that, you know, growing up in Elwood City in western Pennsylvania, I can remember my civics teacher. I actually had a couple, you know, because you take American government and then you take a couple other things related to civics. I had some great teachers, and of course, maybe that ultimately, you know, kind of steered me to the direction I did with my legislative work. So yeah, I just assumed that too. We are in Pennsylvania. We have this rich history regarding our American founding and important battles and everything. Valley Forge, Gettysburg. We would just have great civics programming, but it turns out that doesn't seem to be the case, at least according to the Fordham Institute.
The other, you know, the thing that, as you're talking, I'm just thinking people are probably, because we do, I think by and large we want the education to be local, but we do have kind of standards that we enforce across the board. And we get those reports every year. Well, the X amount of students in fourth grade are reading at a fourth grade level. So we've established what a fourth grade reading level is. Same thing with math. Like, we don't have some districts, oh, we'll get around to multiplication when you get into eighth grade. Well, no. This can't be that difficult to just set some standards of, hey, these are things that you have to know in seventh grade. Like, it just seems, again, we are able to do this in other educational areas, establish this as what the expectation is anyway for students in these grade levels. It seems like this ought to be a fairly simple fix that, hey, by the end of seventh grade, your kiddos ought to know this, by the end of eighth grade, and so on and so forth.
Yep, I think you're spot on. I think that's the way it should be working, and I think it does work that way in a number of states. Unfortunately, our state standards aren't that specific in terms of grade level, what you should know when you're in this particular grade or coming out of this in particular grade. And the other dynamic that's at play here that I think we can all recognize is, In Pennsylvania, we require 180 days of public education each year for our kids, grades 1 through 12, right? And so stuffed into 5 days a week, typically, of so many hours a day, I don't know, 8 o'clock to, 2:30 or 3, we do want them to learn their math. We do want them to learn reading. We do want them to learn sciences. We do also want them to have some physical activity that helps improve their physical condition. So we're trying to cram into those hours each day and 5 days a week over 180 days a lot of stuff. And so I think at some point civics has kind of gone by the wayside because we have to push other things. And I understand the importance of all those other things. But we're going to have to come up with some way to also focus on civics education, because it really does matter what our students, as they come out of 12th grade, how they view our nation, how they view their communities, how they view the world, and then do they have the ability to properly process what's going on around them? And more importantly than that, once they process what's going on, can they be a positive, active force in their community, in their state and nation to help work on the problems we have and find solutions?
All right, now, Jim, we'll take a break here in a little bit, and I've got some opinion questions to ask you, but here's one. How much of this is political? All right, everything seemingly is political now. Red, blue, left, right, all this stuff. Could some of this actually somehow, coming out of Harrisburg now, could some of this be political, that you've got some people, they want to push things in certain directions, or am I just off on that?
Well, I know you want to go to break. All this came about, PA Civics came about through the work we've been doing as organizations and as former members of Congress has nothing to do with what's going on in Harrisburg. I can tell you, there's always the situation where people's political views might come into play in terms of how they view issues and how they view what should be done. But we, in our PA Civics group, we're very clear. We are nonpartisan, and we are simply focused on promoting civics education. And what your views are on that policy issue versus that policy issue is up to your organization. We're not involved in that. We're simply, how do we come up with a better system educationally to provide our students with the best quality civics education possible without being political. In fact, Joe Hoffel is a Democrat. I'm a Republican. We're also adding two additional state co-chairs that have been former state elected officials, Keith McCall, former House Speaker, a Democrat, and former state senator, had been president pro tem in the Senate, Joe Scarnati. So they'll be joining us as co-chairs. And again, we're not about politics, we're about civics education, and I think that's the right approach on this.
All right, well, that's good to hear. All right, we'll take our break here. because unfortunately it seems like politics kind of weasels its way into so many things. So that's good to hear. Our guest again is Jim Gerlach, former congressman with the group called PA Civics. Now, Jim, when we come back, I'll warn you, I have some opinion questions for you. Maybe if you were a congressman today, how would you be handling certain things? I've just prepared you, all right? You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox. We'll come right back.
Finally, the soundtrack of summer is returning to the airwaves here in Happy Valley. And it's doing so right here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox. This year's Pittsburgh Pirates offer a mix of veteran stars.
Andrew McCutcheon has won it! They're going crazy! The Pirates have won this game!
And perhaps baseball's newest shining star.
The 2-2. He got him, and he's done it again. Paul Skeens finishes strong.
Every game all season long brings the promise of new excitement.
The Bucks walk it off in grand fashion.
Don't miss the action of Pirates baseball this season. The Buccos are back here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox.
Raise the Jolly Roger!
The Center Hall Farm Store is proud to serve our community as a small family business that provides big-time service. Folks, you can still stock up on those wood pellets this winter. The Center Hall Farm Store makes its own horse, cow, pig, chicken, and bird feeds and has a great variety of pet feeds for your needs. Open weekdays from 8 to 4 and Saturday from 8 to noon. Check us out at 110 Allison Street in Center Hall or on the web at centerhallfarmstore.com. That's centerhallfarmstore.com. The Center County Recycling and Refuse Authority is proud to support local sports here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox. Check out our website at centercountyrecycles.org for employment opportunities, upcoming events, the authority's newsletter, and details on what can and can't be recycled, as well as updated schedules. That's centercountyrecycles.org. Once again, the website is centercountyrecycles.org.
It's the Kubota Orange Day sales event at Daughter Equipment just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. Friday, April 11th, 8 to 5. Saturday, April 12th from 8 till noon, test drive equipment. Get the best deals of the season. Get 10% off all in-stock parts along with door prizes and giveaways. And do not forget the pancake breakfast from 8 to 11 both days. The Kubota Orange Day sales event features zero down, 0% APR for 84 months on select Kubota models. On some models, you can save up to $3,500 with cash purchase. Just ask the Kubota experts at your destination for Kubota. Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. Mark the dates on your calendar for the Kubota Orange Day sales event of the year, April 11th from 8 to 5 and the 12th from 8 till noon. Daughter Equipment, your destination for Kubota. 0% APR financing now through 6/30/2025. See Daughter Equipment just south of Mill Hall on Route 64 or go to KubotaUSA.com. For more information.
The Fox.
It's Let's Talk here on a Tuesday morning. Jeff and Scott with you. We will have a little open phone time coming up in the final segment of this morning's big show.
Again, our guest is Jim Gerlach, former congressman from the, we'll say, the greater Philadelphia area, involved with a group called PA Civics. Again, there was an event last month called Civic Learning Week aimed at schools. And I saw this and I thought, oh, there's a topic to talk about. Now, Jim, I tell you what, I want to move a little bit, not about the kids. Let's talk about the adults, okay? And
yes.
Some opinion questions, and you can answer these however you wish, however you like, okay? My first question is very simply, your opinion, and I'm just going to blurt it. Essentially, how many Americans are clueless about how government works, how our government works. They really have no idea how it works.
And a quick follow-up. How many people in government are completely clueless about... No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
Jim, go ahead.
That's pretty good.
Well.
A lot. I could say a lot. I think there's a substantial number of our citizens, fellow citizens, that aren't as up to date as they should be on what's going on with our system of government, and more importantly, the role they play as citizens, the really important role they play. The Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania a few years back had a study, and if that's accurate, one out of six fellow citizens can't name the three branches of government, is executive, legislative, and judicial. And a majority of our fellow citizens can't name all of the First Amendment rights that we have. Now, I would say I think most of us can name most of the First Amendment rights, but we may not get quite all of them. But we do know, bottom line is when I would go around the district, a lot of people would say, oh, hi, Senator, thinking I'm still in the state Senate rather than having been in Congress for 6 years or 8 years. And that always kind of tickled me. Or some people would think when they would see me at the, at the grocery store, everything, that I, might have, been a school board member. They didn't realize I was actually in Congress. So, and I think a lot of people also did not understand the process can be kind of complicated, the legislative process, but they just didn't have a basic understanding of the different powers among the judicial and executive and legislative branches. So I think there's room for growth. Let's put it that way. Room for growth among our fellow citizens and understanding what we're based upon as a nation. And most importantly, their important role that they can play in participating. And participating can be a lot of different ways. Being registered to vote and voting every election cycle, but it could be helping out, at the local food bank. It could be identifying a problem with the lack of youth sports opportunities in our community. So let's work on developing the opportunities for kids to participate in sport. Could be Meals on Wheels. It could be helping at the hospital. Good citizenship has a lot of ways to be expressed, and it's not just the three branches of government and are you voting? But that's certainly part of it too. You should be actively engaged in selecting who our leaders are and are going to be in the future.
All right. I could have fun with my friend the Ironhead, the freedoms in the First Amendment. Let me help. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, that one gets mentioned a lot lately, freedom of religion, freedom to gather peaceably, freedom to address government with grievances.
Correct.
That's it. There it is.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My pocket constitution is way over there on a desktop, so I'm not even reading this. It was off the top of my head. So, okay, now following that vein, Jim, from your observation or knowledge, parts of government that people just don't understand, they misunderstand how things work. They think it works a certain way when it works actually this way. Just off the top of your head, what are some things that are just really misunderstood about our system of government?
I think a lot of people believe that elected officials don't really care about what they think and don't take into consideration their views. That was never my experience. The most important lobbyist that could ever come into my office to express an opinion and ask for consideration of a yes vote or a no vote was the actual constituents in my district. Because A, if they were going to come into my office and talk about a particular issue, it means that issue is going to impact them personally in some way. And so they also have a very real world experience with that issue. And so, the most important lobbyist for an elected official in the entire world is just the men and women that live in that representative's district who can educate the representative on the real-world impact of a particular policy issue. And so most folks didn't get that. Most folks, well, they get elected, and, of course, they raised a lot of money to get elected, so they're probably just listening to the rich people or the people in this particular interest group, when, again, my experience was really I learned the most and really needed the input of average citizens in my district to really understand the impact of policy decisions I would make by my vote. So that's number one. Number two, particularly at the federal level, it is a particularly challenging situation when the problems our local folks are facing could be a local business, could be a particular group. If they're being caught up in the executive branch agency's process, this regulatory process, how do you get regulators to take the time to understand the impact of that regulation or the impact of the decision they made based on a regulation, and then take into consideration the uniqueness of that particular constituent's problem, and then basically exercise common sense and come up with a regulatory decision that is the best outcome. The great majority of executive branch workers, both at the state and federal level that I came in contact with, wanted to do the right thing, wanted to do the common sense thing. They might have been held back because the regulation is the regulation and they had no flexibility, and therefore you have to either eliminate the regulation or change the regulation to have gotten the remedy that you needed for your constituent, and that can be very, very frustrating. But again, that's a separation of powers thing that citizens understand our system understood, but couldn't understand, you know, just the lack of common sense in that whole process. So just working every day on the constituent service side of things to work with executive branch agencies to get them to come up with realistic and common sense solutions to the problems that my constituents were having. That was a challenge, and a challenge for our team, our staff, as well as our constituents. But as I say, most of the executive branch workers really wanted to do it right and get the right decision made, and sometimes they were just hamstrung by the nature of the regulation itself or the actual law. So those were a couple of things I learned over my 24 years of experience.
All right. Okay, let's just a general thought, Jim. All right, the last 3 months have been interesting. Okay,
yeah.
I'm giggling and laughing. Interesting. Yeah, that's the understatement of the century. As a former congressman, when you're looking, I'm thinking about D.C. now, when you're looking at what's been transpiring over the last 2.5 to 3 months down there, what comes to mind? What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that I think there's a lot of good things that are happening down there, but some things that, while they should be happening in a maybe different way. Let me pull out the Doge stuff that's happening. I'm convinced that, given the nature of our appropriations process in Congress, where the Appropriations Committee in the House and Senate start working on the 14 appropriations bills that comprise each fiscal year's budget, they basically start that work in about March, and they're supposed to move those bills through the process in their chamber, hopefully by summer recess, and then any differences work those out in the early fall to get them all worked out by the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. The reality is that process hasn't worked that way for at least 15 or 20 years, and so we're always in this continuing resolution mode where we just pass temporary spending bills until the final bill can be done. But what I believe happens is there's not enough time for particularly the appropriations bills and the subcommittees the Appropriations Committee and their subcommittees, actually delve into the line items of funding to find the fraud, waste, and abuse. They might find one or two instances and try to address it in that appropriations process that year, but to do a wholesale review of fraud and waste and abuse, they just don't have the time, given the weekly schedule in Washington and then being back in their home districts when they're not in session, And so I think, number one, this DOGE process where it's executive branch driven to go through and say, look at all these expenditures that we're making that are totally wasteful. Why do we have 27, one agency have 27 chief information officers? If there's 27 chief information officers, there must not be a chief information officer, right? Why are some of our agencies still working off computer systems that are 30 years old, and yet there have been IT contractors for those same 20 years that are supposed to have been updating those systems and haven't done so, but are still under contract 20 years later? You know, so there is tremendous amount of waste in our system, and yet I don't think the Congress itself has the ability to find it, examine it, come up with a remedy, and pass that in the process each year. So I think there has to be an executive branch, presidential-based effort to really do that. However, with that said, I think the better approach would have been if President Trump would have done this through a presidential task force, not a commission that's going to do a bunch of hearings and everything, but actually a task force working group made up of not only his people in the executive branch, but representatives from Congress on a bipartisan basis, so Republicans and Democrats, not a big group, but a small group of House and Senate Republicans and D's that are assigned to that same task force, and they're all walking through these line items in these various agencies together. I think that would go a much further distance in terms of identifying not only waste and fraud and abuse, but also on a bipartisan basis coming up with a solution to address it. Because right now, as you know, everybody can see, many Democrats are concerned that this is just President Trump and Elon Musk that have decided to cut this, cut that. And while I think there's tons of those opportunities that should be taken to reduce that waste and abuse, I think the process should have been co-branch, executive and legislative, and bipartisan. Not just a commission, which would have had formal hearings, and that would have taken a lot of time, but basically a task force, a working group that informally, day after day, could be working through these line items in the budget, and I think find a lot of stuff that everybody could agree needs to be eliminated or reduced or reformed. And I think that would have been a little better process.
All right. Jim, I'm not sure this is Scott. I'm not sure I quite agree. And, okay, now you're somebody that was on the inside. Up till the last 3 months, seemingly, just looking from the outside, nobody in Congress, nobody in either party, seemingly was willing to do any of what you just described. And nothing was happening. And meanwhile, we have a $2 trillion hole in the budget every year, which is going to blow up in our faces at some point in the future, that, okay, let's bring in a bunch of outside people and let's cut them loose. And granted, it's been chaotic, it's been a little crazy, but at least I think they've gotten some stuff done. Jim, I'm not sure if you might bipartisan sounds great. I'm not sure those folks would have gotten anything done. I think that somebody would have put the brakes on, somebody would have started playing politics, and it would have gone nowhere. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you to the extent that it has to be led by the chief executive. Because if you wait for Congress to have its input and even to take votes on a lot of this stuff, it isn't going to happen, or it isn't going to happen in the near future. But my suggestion was having a task force, a rapid response task force that could provide input, still allow the chief executive to make the decisions moving forward, but having that input, I think it was really important. Give you an example. When I last two Congresses I was in, I had a bill that would have a proposal that was in bill form that would have allowed for about $30 billion in Medicare savings over 10 years by simply moving to basically a debit card type system where a Medicare recipient and the Medicare provider, doctor, hospital, would each have a debit card that would be swiped at the time of medical transaction. So so that the system would instantly know, yep, Mary Jones or John Brown are definitely Medicare recipients. Yes, Dr. Jones or Dr. Brown is a certified Medicare physician, so that transaction can go through. That would have eliminated about $30 billion in fraudulent and wasteful Medicare spending every 10 years. Got a good hearing on it in the Ways and Means Committee, a lot of bipartisan support, but basically that's as far as it went. So I think there's a number of members that want to be part of the solution to find and eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse, but you know, having to introduce a bill and then go through hearings, and then even if you get it out of committee, you got to pass it on the floor, and even if you pass it on the floor in the House, it's got to go to the Senate, and it's got to go through the same thing. Our system is meant to be that way. The founders meant it to be slow and deliberative, but I think we need more of a rapid response than that current process allows for eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, given that, like you said, a $36 trillion debt. So I'm not saying the president shouldn't have that rapid responsibility. I just think he should have a task force around him that includes input from members of Congress, both R and D. Not that they can stop it with a vote, but have that input in the process as it's moving forward. That's my point.
All right, Jim, I'll bite. I'm simply curious, what is your opinion of Donald Trump?
Well, I think President Trump is doing a lot of things he was elected to do, including border security, getting our economy on track, making sure that we're right-setting our relationships with many countries across the globe. And so I think he's undertaking what the American people want him to undertake, and I think he's doing it very effectively. However, with that said, I am, you know, if anybody in scale got some money in a retirement account, we're all kind of wobbly need right now over this tariff effort. Hopefully it works out to our benefit as a country and to us individually. But I think he needs to be clearer on that and a little more specific on how this is going to play out over time. Hopefully, knock on wood, it works out for everybody, particularly Americans and our economy. But I am concerned right now with that. But with that said, I think he's largely doing what he said he wanted to do if he were elected a second time. And a majority of Americans support that. And I think he needs to be given the time and the space to accomplish all that.
I mean, all this tariff stuff is a little dizzying. In your tenure, I don't recall anything quite like this. I read some piece that Richard Nixon did something over 50 years ago. He did something with tariffs and so on. How do you think this is going to turn out?
Very, very open question. We did a couple free trade agreements when I was in Congress. We did the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I think we did one with South Korea. And those agreements specifically were meant to, you know, right-size our trade relationship with those other countries in terms of our tariffs. And I think they largely worked out. I think the trading relationship with us and those countries have been largely a good thing. But we also learned, too, from all of this, it's not just tariffs. It's other trade barriers that countries might put up that aren't part of a free trade agreement necessarily. For example, the European Union countries have this VAT tax, value-added tax, so not only are American companies paying a certain tariff to send their product into Europe, and then what might be tacked on top of that in terms of the price is the value-added tax at the consumer level there in Germany or France or Belgium, whatever it is. So, and those VAT taxes or those changes in trade requirements can vary from year to year to year. So what the trading world looked like when I left Congress in 2015 can be totally different than what it is right now, 2025. So I think President Trump's underlying view that Americans are getting taken to the cleaners by trade policies of foreign countries is largely accurate. But we also have to bear in mind that whatever we do, they can do to us too. So I think we have to be careful what we ask for, because they can take retaliatory measures that don't help us any further than where we are today. So a lot of it's going to be, over the next few months, these negotiations. Will the president, or will President Trump's administration be able to work out individual agreements with various countries in a way that when that dust settles, we come out further ahead as an economy than where we were? And again, let's all, regardless of party affiliation, let's all knock on wood that that happens, because that'll help Americans. But will that happen? I don't know, because I think we're on totally new ground that I've not seen in my adult lifetime. Whether President Nixon did it or not this way, I don't know. But we're in new territory here, and just hoping this strategy ultimately works out. We're going to know in the next few months, one way or the other.
Okay. Well, Jim, I tell you what, we got to take a break, but we appreciate your time today, and I want to keep an eye on PA Civics, your group, because, yeah, kids need to learn this stuff.
Yes.
They need to learn this stuff. So appreciate your time and your opinions, and thanks for joining us again today.
Yeah. Thank you, fellas. Have a great day. Thanks for having me.
First